Welcome back to the Tuesday, July 7th edition of Talkback. I'm Peter Christian Christensen, taking your phone calls this morning. And we are always privileged to have with us Dr. John Lott on the phone, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Dr. Lott, good morning and welcome back, sir.
Oh, it's always great to talk to you, Peter and Nick. Thanks for having me on.
So how goes the battle, sir? I know that basically we're talking about firearms and the privilege and the rights that we have as Americans and how you're on a daily basis fighting that battle. So share with us what's your current focus right now.
I mean, there's been a lot that's happened in the last couple of weeks just with regard to the Supreme Court, both with regard to the Hamani case dealing with marijuana possession. Obviously, there's a fair number of people in Montana who either for medical reasons or others use marijuana. The federal government said that if you used even one time, you'd be banned basically from being able to go and own guns. The Supreme Court struck down those laws. And then you had a big case that I was involved with amicus brief and some other activity with regard to Hawaii. You had in 2022, the Supreme Court in the Bruin case struck down the concealed carry restrictions that were in seven states, Hawaii, New York, California, New Jersey, Maryland, and so on. And basically they said, look, you have to have a law like we've had in Montana, where once you meet certain objective criteria, you know, a certain age, you pass criminal background check, you pay your fee, once you've met those criteria and you apply for a permit, then it should automatically be granted. What those seven states had done was that they'd also said, well, you have to prove to some local public official that you have a good reason for being able to go and defend yourself. And the Supreme Court said that's you can't do that. You have to have objective rules because, in fact, they were very subjective in terms of how they were applying the rules, who they approved. But what happened was some of the states, four of the states, basically said, okay, if you're going to force us to go and issue permits, we're going to make it so you can't use them in place. So California, New York, and Hawaii, in Maryland were the states that basically said, okay, well, in Hawaii, you had to get prior approval from any property owner, like a gas station or whatever, from the owner that you were allowed to carry your permitted concealed handgun on the property there. Essentially, I mean, they knew it. In fact, in the legislative debate, they made it clear that they thought that that would effectively ban people from being able to go and carry off of their property. And the Supreme Court struck that down. So, it's just one of a change. Plus, the Supreme Court recently agreed that it would go and hear this next year these assault weapon ban cases that are there. There's one that they took from the Chicago area, and other that they took from Connecticut. I think that's going to be a major case. That's going to, because my own guess is the Supreme Court's going to say, look, you can't just ban guns like that if they're commonly owned in the United States. So it's kind of referred to as the AR-15 type ban, which there's probably easily well over 20 million or so of them out there. And, you go and just as an aside on this, you go and you listen to the debates when legislatures pass these things, it's pretty clear these guys have no clue about the different types of guns there. AR-15 is a semi-automatic rifle. About 85% of the guns that are sold in the United States are semi-automatics. And it's a relatively small caliber. And in most states in the United States, you're not even allowed to use an AR-15 to go and hunt deer, because the concern is that with the small caliber there, you'll wound and won't kill the animal, and it'll just go and suffer. Mm. And so, you know, but it fires bullets with the same rapidity, doing essentially the same damage as any small caliber hunting rifle out there. And, but, you know.
Well, Dr. Lott, we're running up against a hard break here, and we want to invite folks, if you have a question for Dr. Lott, he's going to be with us till 10 o'clock this morning. So please feel free to give us a call, 406-721-1290. We'll be right back after this quick timeout on the Montana Talks Radio Network. Hey, we're back on Talk Back. Good to have you along this morning. Our special guest on the phone, Dr. John Lott, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. We already have a caller on the line. Emmett, good morning. You're on with Dr. Lott. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Well, I do have a question, Dr. Lott. It's about the crime statistics. Donald Trump has said we have the lowest murder rate in over 100 years. It's wonderful. Is that really true? Because I would still be afraid to live in a big city and walk down the streets to go shopping or go to a restaurant. You know, I used to live in Tucson, and I locked myself at home for fear of crime. And, you know, I mean, are assaults really down? Oh, and also, do we still have the National Guard in big cities? I still think we need them. So if you could update me on those things and give us a better perspective. I'm kind of iffy on those numbers. I wish they were true. But if you have any insight onto that.
Emmett, thanks for the call. Dr. Lott, please.
Sure. Well, I mean, the federal government has been collecting national data on murder since 1900. And prior to last year, the lowest murder rate that we ever had was about 4.5 per 100,000. In 2024, it was about 5 per 100,000. And it looks like... I think it's pretty clear that the murder rate last year actually was slightly below 4 per 100,000. So that's a significant drop from what it was in 2024. And it's, you know, about 1/9 lower than the lowest previous murder rate that we ever had. You know, with regard to violent crime across the board, we have two measures of crime. We have crimes reported to police, and that's the FBI data. And then we have data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which tries to get a measure of total violent crime, both reported and unreported. And to do that, they have what's really truly massive survey of about 240,000 people that they do each year. And they've been doing this for over 50 years. And the reason why we've done this is we've known for a long time that most crimes aren't reported to police. About 43% of violent crimes are reported to police. About 30% of property crimes are reported to police. And so, and in fact, you know, there was a big debate during the 2024 election. A lot of people would point, the media would point to the FBI data, which showed about an 8% drop in violent crime. But the Bureau of Justice Statistics measure of total crime during that period of time showed a 59% increase, the largest percentage increase over any four-year period of time that we've ever seen. Now, we're not going to have, I mean, the FBI data again shows a drop in reported crime for last year, reported violent crime, reported property crime. But we're not going to get the data on the total until September. My guess is, though, I think pretty clear, we're going to see a large drop in reported crime. And look, it's something we've talked about when I've been on the show before. It's not rocket science. If you want to go and reduce crime, you have to make it riskier for criminals to commit crime. And you do that with things like higher arrest rates, higher conviction rates, longer prison sentences, and also letting victims be able to go and defend themselves. And all those things changed last year from what they were before. You know, you look at arrests by the FBI. The FBI doubled the number of arrests in 2025 compared to what they had in 2024. You had U.S. attorneys around the country that during the Biden administration just were basically refusing to go and prosecute violent criminals. In Washington, D.C., which is unique because the U.S. attorney there, who's appointed by the president, is in charge of prosecuting all crimes by adults, not just federal crimes. And in that case, in 2022, he refused to bring charges against 67% of the people who were arrested. About 60% of the people who were arrested in 2023, he refused to bring charges against.
Wow.
Judge Jeanine Pirro, who is the current U.S. attorney, she's very different.
Yeah.
She's bringing charges against 96% of those who have been arrested. And not only is she bringing charges, but the ones that she is prosecuting, she's asking for serious penalties with regard to them. So those are things that have changed. Plus, look, it's not surprising to me. During the Biden administration, we had this record increase in violent crime. At the same time, we had this huge record increase in illegal aliens coming into the country.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know exactly how many came in. There are different components to it. If you add up those that turned themselves at the border, those that were caught in so-called gotaways, people that we see coming across but we didn't catch, there's something over 12 million fall into those three categories. Now, there's a fourth category of ones that we didn't see coming across. And, you know, you had like 67% of Border Patrol agents were pulled off of guarding the border and instead were being used to prosecute illegals coming into the country. You had about 30% of the passive monitoring equipment along the border was broken and Biden administration refused to fix. So you had large areas of the border where we had no eyes on them and nobody trying to catch anybody. And so we have no idea how many more millions, you know, could have been 20 million that came in. And by the way, there is an estimate that just came out from the Federal Reserve indicating that the massive flow of 20 million maybe people coming into the country illegally, plus millions more legally coming in, was responsible for about 30% increase in house prices, and also responsible for a big increase in rents. So,
That's basically becoming a supply and demand issue with the rapidly.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're coming up against a break. Phone lines are open. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. John Lott, we would love to hear from you. The number is 406-721-1290, 1-800-568-5309. Dr. Lott, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Great conversation underway. We'll be back right after this quick timeout. Welcome back. This is the Tuesday, July 7th edition of Talk Back. Peter Christian here, Mr. Nick Christensen taking your phone calls, and our special guest on the phone, Dr. John Lott, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Tony is on the line from Stevensville. Tony, good morning. You're on with Dr. Lott. Go ahead, please.
Good morning. I have a question about getting commercial licenses. We've been hearing that illegal aliens that don't even speak English are getting commercial licenses, and we've seen a couple of very bad accidents where citizens have been killed. I'm wondering how Montana handles commercial licenses. Do they strictly prohibit anybody from not gaining a license that doesn't speak English?
Well, I mean, that's federal law. They're supposed to do that. They're supposed to make sure that the person can go and pass the test. You know, you've had problems with states like California and Washington State and New York going and granting licenses for commercial driver's licenses to people. One of the things that they found has happened is that if somebody can't speak English, they are allowing them to have somebody to come in to help them, you know, essentially translate the questions, supposedly.
Wow.
But they have found that the individuals actually are taking the test for them. So, you know, because you have these individuals that get pulled over in these different states, and they can't even identify the signs. I mean, it's not like you need to know a lot of English in order to go and, you know what, you know, a sign that says, you know, no right turn or something like that. I mean, maybe for some of those you need to have some English, but a lot of them you don't. And yet, you know, you go and look at the tests and they can get like 4 wrong out of 5 signs that they're asked to look at. So, you know, it's the Trump administration has essentially been going through trying to get the lists of who they've given the licenses to. They've had to fight them in court because states like New York and California have fought against providing that information so that they could go and check to see whether or not the person is here legally in the country and, you know, and check whether the licenses were properly given out. But they're working. I don't suspect that there's a problem at all in a state like Montana.
Oh, great. Glad to hear that.
All right, thank you for the call, sir. We appreciate it. Okay, phone lines are open. We have about 3 minutes left in our time together this hour. If you have a question for Dr. Lott, please give us a call right now, 406-721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309. And when it comes to people crossing the southern border, these are primarily non-English-speaking people, right? And so how are they expected to be able to read the signs and be able to get where they need to go?
Right. Well, I mean, the federal government under the Biden administration was going and giving them free trips to places and setting them up in different places to go and live, providing them with the $2,500 prepaid credit cards that were there. You know, so, you know, they provided all sorts of help. Now, we don't need that now because the number of people coming in to the country illegally has been literally cut to about zero. I mean, maybe there's, you know, 3 or 4 that have gotten in that we haven't seen. But the border agents are back guarding the border. The passive monitoring equipment that was broken and not fixed during the Biden administration has been fixed. We've had a lot of troops put down in different parts of the border in order to guard it. And, of course, they're gotten back and constructing the wall. You know, one of the things that had happened during the Biden administration, just to show you how serious they were about undermining these things, is that the border wall equipment that hadn't yet been used at the end of the first Trump administration, the Biden administration was selling it off for scrap, literally pennies on the dollar.
Wow.
So that when, and they sped that up when Trump won election in 2024 so that they would make it more difficult for them to go back and finish building the wall, even though the money had been allocated. They wanted to sell it off cheaply and have it melted down and destroyed so that it couldn't be used.
Wow. Well, we're about a minute away from the end of this particular hour. So, Dr. Lott will be with us, by the way, all the way till 10 o'clock this morning. So we really appreciate him sharing his valuable time with us as he's the president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center and an author of I don't know how many books. And when we come back, maybe at the top of the hour, we'll ask to get an update on what he's been working on as far as his amazing book writing skills. So we're going to talk about that when we come back and take your phone calls as well. That's why he's here to talk with you folks. 406-721-1290, 1-800-568-5309. And we're privileged to have you on with us, Dr. Lott, and, of course, all of you listening across the state, statewide on the Montana Talks Radio Network. So we're looking forward to continuing our conversation with Dr. Lott for another hour coming right up. Again, that's 406-721-1290, 1-800-568-5309, back after the top of the hour. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Hour number 2 of Talk Back is underway now with this Tuesday, July 7th. And I just want to say a welcome to all of our statewide listening audience on the Montana Talks Radio Network. We'd like to introduce you to Dr. John Lott, who's president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center, a very, very good friend of TalkBack over the years. And Dr. Lott, it is, again, a pleasure to have you, sir. And all of your research and you've authored numerous books, and no one has a better grasp on what's going on with firearms in America than the Crime Prevention Research Center. So, Dr. Lott, good morning and welcome once again, sir.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's always great to talk to you, Peter and Nick. I always enjoy it, and always, I do a lot of radio and TV, but the nice thing about your show is that you get calls from the audience. I mean, that's kind of a lost art. 20 years ago or something, you would get that. But your station is about the only one that I get on where I get calls from the audience.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, just real quickly, in a minute or so, capsulize what the Crime Prevention Research Center is and your work with it, sir.
Sure. Well, I mean, my own background, I've been an academic most of my life. I've had researcher teaching positions at Stanford, University of Chicago, the Wharton Business School, Yale, UCLA, Rice. I was chief economist for the United States Sentencing Commission in Washington. And more recently, I was the senior advisor for research and statistics in the U.S. Department of Justice. And basically, the Crime Prevention Research Center is a group of academics from around the country. We have people who've been affiliated with Harvard and with the Wharton Business School, University of Chicago, basically people that I got to know in my travels around the academia, who know crime data. So anything that deals with crime, anything from policing to just understanding the different measures of crime, to vote fraud, to gun control type issues. If it's something that deals with crime, there's at least a reasonable chance it's something that we've dealt with.
Well, I know that your organization is filling a niche that basically was empty before you started, and the fact that you're able to provide the public and have a kind of a conduit between crime prevention agencies and the public.
Right. Well, I like to think that we go and fill a gap that's not there. I mean, just kind of helping people understand. I mean, the previous half hour that we were doing this, we just had a question about, different measures of crime. I don't think the media does a very good job of educating people on this. And it's just not in the United States. It's around the world. I mean, I've been involved in debates in the last few weeks for everybody from Australia to Canada to Europe. And I'm going to be going down to Argentina and Ecuador in the next month to go and give talks to police groups and to politicians in different countries. So it's, you take something like vote fraud. We basically were the ones who put together the data on what other countries do with regard to voter IDs, with regard to rules like mail-in ballots. People don't appreciate how unique the United States is in terms of not having basic safeguards to prevent vote fraud that we see in other countries. Some of the other
we're going to come right back, and we have about 10 seconds left before a hard break. We have Fred and Rick both standing by waiting to visit with you. We'll do that when we come back from the break. We're Dr. John Lott with the Crime Prevention Research Center right after this on the Montana Talks Radio Network. Welcome back to Talk Back, everybody. Glad to have you along. I'm Peter Christian. That is Mr. Nick Christensen over there. Again, privileged to have Dr. John Lott, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. And so let's get right to the phones.
Oh. Let's let John just wrap up real quick.
Oh, yeah,
we had to cut him off there, and then we'll get to Rick's call.
Oh, it's all right. I mean, I pretty much said what I wanted to say. The only thing I could add would be that one of the things we've been working on recently is just comparing crime rates in the United States versus other countries. There are two measures of crime. One is crimes reported to police, and that's what the media in all these different countries tend to use. The problem is that Americans are much more likely to report crimes to the police than victims in other countries. And so even if the true crime rate was exactly the same in the United States and, let's say, Canada or other countries, it would make it look like the crime rate was higher in the United States than in those other countries, simply because people report them more to the police. And right. So what you need to look at is total crimes, both reported and unreported. And when you do that, you find that these other countries have much higher violent crime rates than the United States. The violent crime rate in Canada, for example, is about 295% higher. It's almost 300% higher than the violent crime rate in the United States. You have a similar, like 2.5 times higher violent crime rate in Australia than you have here in the United States. But you go to these different countries and people think that they have a low crime rate relative to the United States. And it's simply because, you take something like rapes. In the United States, about 45% of rapes and sexual assaults are reported to police. In Australia, it's like 19%. I think it's actually lower than that, but that's the official number that they give out. You can see what's such a huge difference. You wouldn't want to just look at the number of rapes and sexual assaults reported to go and figure out how it compares in the different countries. And when you actually look at total rapes and sexual assaults, it's like 3 times higher in Australia than it is in the U.S.
Wow. Well,
that's one thing we've been working on.
We have a couple of folks waiting on the line to visit with you. Fred, sure. From St. Regis. Fred, good morning, sir. You're on with Dr. Lott. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, good morning. You guys are talking about the commercial driver's licenses. I was a safety officer for a family-owned trucking outfit. There was about 250 employees there. And we're dealing with that situation. I can spot those guys on the road when I'm driving. Here's the deal. The poor highway patrol guy or the scales guy that pulls that over, he's at the bottom of the food chain with the enforcement. All the violations per company, any violation at any company goes into the federal database. You could search that thing and go after the people that own the company. It took me 4 days to hire a new driver just with the background checks, and then we were required to have a 40-hour ride-along because, particularly with the newer folks, you need to go after the guys that are running the companies that hire these because they're not doing their job.
Right. Well, I'm sure they can go and figure out whether somebody can speak English and whether or not they can go and know what the different road signs mean. I mean, they shouldn't have to necessarily just depend upon the federal, the state licensing organizations for doing that. It's something that's a real safety issue. If somebody can't determine what the different signs mean along the road, they're a danger to not only themselves, but to others. And, I'm just glad the Trump administration is at least cracking down on the licenses that have been given out to these people.
Yeah, the company that hires the guy, though, is not doing their job is what I'm getting at. Or they're ignoring the regulations.
That's the first point I made. Yeah.
And that's where to really put the bite on this, because all you have to do is suspend that DOT number that's on the side of the truck, and that truck cannot move from that forward. You have to tow it. Shut the company down. And it'd start putting some fear of God in some of these guys that are re-registering themselves as soon as they get a little bit of a hassle. They start a new company. Get a new DOT number, and somebody on the end up there is not, on the federal side, is not searching their databases, because you're supposed to do that also. But if I'm driving down the road, and that guy's not even maintaining his line, I know that that guy's not capable of driving the truck. So just my two bits worth in. That's my solution to it. Go after the owner of the company and put him in jail or put the fine on him, and I think this thing would slow down real quick.
Thank you so much for the call, and thank you for your experience and sharing it with us. We appreciate it. John, go ahead, please.
Well, I mean, I pretty much said the same thing earlier on, before when he first made his point. I don't think there was anything new there, but
Go ahead.
Say, we can go to Rick. Yeah, we can
Let's go to Rick.
Next
Rick, good morning. You're on TalkBack. Go ahead, please.
Yes, John, I'd like to ask a question about the definition and how it's applied. Hate crimes. Like, say, for instance, if you're in Boulder, Colorado, and you throw accelerant on protesters and try to set them on fire, and the protesters are there for a particular political reason, that obviously that, in my mind, would be a hate crime. But if you're walking down the street in New York and you're shot in the back going to a conference by what appears to be a middle class or upper middle class person, people try to argue that that is not a hate crime and should not be prosecuted as a hate crime. But it wasn't a crime of monetary means or anything like that. It was actually a crime of revenge, in my mind. Or if you go to a Supreme Court justice's house and you protest and things get out of hand, how do they separate that just things getting out of hand and that protest is actually a hate crime?
Okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We'll have John answer that question when we come back. We're like seconds away from a hard break. And so we will remember what you asked and get that answered for you when we come back from the break. 406-721-1290 is our number. Statewide Talk Back on the Montana Talks Radio Network will continue right after this quick timeout. Hey, welcome back. It's the Tuesday edition of Talk Back. I'm Peter Christian. Nick Christensen is taking your phone calls, producing Talk Back. Our guest on the phone, we're privileged to have with us Dr. John Lott, president, founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. His website, by the way, crimeresearch.org. And, I'll go ahead, please, Nick.
Remember, we had Rick's call before we took the break for you, John.
Yeah, Rick, Rick had some questions for you, so please go ahead.
Of a hate crime. And hate crimes are, I mean, I understand his point that there's a lot of crime that involves the criminal hating the victim in many different ways. You know, you can have a spouse murdering another spouse, or even two rival gang members probably hate each other. But what makes it technically a hate crime under the law is that the criminal is going after the victim because of their actual or perceived identity. You know, so if it's race, if it's religion, those are the types of things. So they're targeting not because, you know, they have some disagreement and they dislike the person themselves, but because they are upset with, you know, their religion or race.
All right. We do have a caller waiting on the line, Mike from Big Timber. Mike, good morning. You're on with Dr. Lott. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question for the doctor. He mentioned a Supreme Court ruling regarding, I think it was the first one he mentioned, regarding marijuana users.
Right.
Could you clarify that? Because those folks that are using marijuana still, regardless if they get a CWP form, it's federal, and also to purchase a firearm, it's a federal form. They don't go through a NICS check if they have a concealed weapons permit, but if they answer, if they lie on that form, they're falsifying their form. Could you clarify that?
Lying on the form is a problem, but that's not basically... Basically, the Supreme Court says the federal government's not allowed to even ban somebody from buying a gun because they're using marijuana. You have to, what the Supreme Court said in the Harmani case is that the person has to be essentially incapacitated, not being able to go and properly function because they are so intoxicated. You know, if you ever want to listen to something amusing, you should listen to the oral arguments in the Harmani case, because you had justices, Gorsuch, for example, going through and talking about how much the founding fathers used to drink all the time. So you had like John Adams, I think, had like a pint of whiskey with breakfast. And Thomas Jefferson didn't really view himself as much of a drinker because he only had six glasses of wine with dinner. So, you know, just going through, I mean, people don't appreciate how much people used to drink alcohol. You know, this is, we didn't really have refrigeration like we have right now. And so essentially alcohol killed germs and stuff that was there.
Well, and, drugs, you know, marijuana does leave you incapacitated in some ways, doesn't it?
Sure, but it's a question of how much and whether you're incapacitated when you are carrying the gun or have it with you. So, you know, somebody can drink alcohol on a Saturday night, and but that doesn't mean that the rest of the time that they're incapacitated. And so what the court was saying is essentially if the person is adjudicated, that means that there's some type of court finding that the person is so inebriated so much of the time that they're not able to kind of go and deal with, you know, proper functions, then you can take away their guns. But what it is saying is that, you know, if you have rules about driving a car while you're drunk, you have rules about being able to go and carry concealed while you're drunk. There's states that ban you from being able to do that. And the same thing is true with marijuana. If you are carrying concealed, you know, you have to be sober. But that doesn't mean that just because in Hamani's case, he would kind of have some marijuana like once every couple days or something like that. It wasn't clear. There was no evidence whether it was just one cigarette that he had or whether it was more. But the way the rules had been, if you had like a gummy, you know, to help you sleep sometime, then you would be banned from being able to go and legally own a gun as a result of that. And the court said, no, you have to have a higher standard to ban somebody from having a gun. Now, again, the rules are different for you just carrying, you know, or having the gun. Then if a state wants to say you have to be sober while you're carrying, just like you're sober while you're driving a car, you know, that's a different animal.
Right. All right. Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the call. And sure. We're about 30 seconds away from a hard break coming up. And we have Jeff and Dave both standing by. Want to remind you that, by the way, Dr. Lott will be with us all the way till 10 o'clock this morning. So if you have a question or a comment about firearms, and there's no one more knowledgeable, in my view, than Dr. John Lott, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. And, of course, his website is crimeresearch.org. We're going to continue our conversation with Jeff and Dave and Dr. Lott, hopefully you as well, at 406-721-1290 right after this quick timeout. Hey, welcome back to Talk Back. I'm Peter Christian and Nick Christensen taking your phone calls this morning. And we have Dr. John Lott joining us all the way till 10 o'clock this morning, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. And we have folks who have been waiting through the break to talk with you. Jeff, good morning. You're on with Dr. Lott. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Dr. Lott. You're one of my favorite guests here. I always enjoy having an opportunity to listen to you and
speak with you.
I have a comment and a question. You were talking about alcohol and the founders. I just read about a bar tab for a 1787 farewell party for George Washington that the founders held. According to a bar tab, the founders drank 54 bottles of Madeira, 60 bottles of claret, 8 bottles of whiskey, 22 bottles of porter, 8 bottles of hard cider, 12 bottles of beer, and 7 bowls of an alcoholic punch. 55 people attended.
Right. All I can say is their tolerance for alcohol is above mine, for sure. No doubt about that. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how much people used to drink, and it's like everybody did. So, and it's, you know, it's basically how they made sure that the water was safe, you know, that what they were drinking was safe, because the alcohol would kill any bugs or anything that was there.
Right, the alcohol and the brewing process. But my question comes around, I listened to your bio, and I've probably heard it, you know, more than a dozen times, but this time I guess I was actually listening, because one of the things your CV says is that you were the senior economist to the U.S. Sentencing Commission?
I was chief economist for the United States Sentencing Commission. The Sentencing Commission basically sets the criminal penalties for all federal crimes. At the time I was there, with the rules that the Sentencing Commission had were kind of mandatory that judges had to follow. Since then, it's more kind of a strong suggestion that they're supposed to follow. But it was interesting.
I just was wondering why the Sentencing Commission would need an economist. You know, what are you trying to find the cheapest bullets or the cost of the electricity?
No, it's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. So basically, do you think the penalties are to be related to the harm from the crime? Okay. Do you think, I'll give you a simple example. One of the debates that occurred while I was at the Sentencing Commission was that they would look to see, you know, like the Exxon Valdez spill, oil spill at the time, and the penalty was just equal to the damage that was done. And yet, if somebody throws a gallon of oil off the side of their boat, you know, the penalty there could be 50 times more than the damage that was done. And, you know, an economist would go and say, well, there may be a simple reason for that, and that is, should the penalty be related to the likelihood that you're going to catch somebody? You know, if I'm going to catch you with certainty, I'm going to, you know, I'll have the penalty equal to the damage that's done. But it's very hard for me to catch, if I only catch like one out of 50 people doing it, I'm going to have a much larger penalty to make sure that the criminal is bearing the damage that he's doing to other people. And so, you know, you have the Exxon Valdez spill. It's not like you can hide it. You know, everybody knows it's Exxon's boat. They are going to them for the, you know, couple billion dollars for cleanup costs that were there. But a lot of it is just trying to figure out what's the probability of catching criminals and what's the harm that they're doing. That's what I did a lot of when I was there.
Okay. I appreciate that. And I also appreciate your low tolerance for fools, and please keep it up.
Okay. Well, I was just off air. I was just telling Peter and Nick how much I enjoy getting the calls from people. But anyway, thank you very much for calling in.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Do we have time? We have less than a minute before we have to take a hard break here, Dr. Lott. But I want to encourage folks, if you have a question for Dr. Lott, now's the time. We still have about 15, 16 minutes left in our time together with him. So give us a call if you have a question at 406-721-1290, 1-800-568-5309. Again, Dr. Lott is president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. We love having him here on TalkBack as a regular guest. And his website, by the way, is crimeresearch.org. That's crimeresearch.org. So if you want to find out more, and of course, author of many, many books, and you can find out what they are, we're right there on his website as well. So we're going to come right back with more with Dr. Lott right after this. All right, talk back, rolling right along. Another 17 minutes left in our time together with Dr. John Lott, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. And Dave has been waiting very patiently on the phone. And so we're going to get to Dave's call here in just a moment. Again, Dr. Lott, with the president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center.
Dave is on.
Oh, Dave, good morning. You're on with Dr. Lott. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I was curious. You know, from my research, election fraud, you talked about it, and our president has said many, many times that he won the 2020 election, but from my research, he was short 37 electoral votes, and that would have required three states results to have been fraudulent, and I have not seen any evidence to back that charge up, and I'm just curious what your view is. Did Donald Trump win the 2020 election and there was fraud in which state it was in?
Right. Well, Dave, this is, I think, the third or fourth time you've asked the same question of me. But I have academic paper. You can go to Social Science Research Network, SSRN.com, and look under my name. I have empirical research that looked at the voting in Pennsylvania and Georgia. You're talking about something like 45,000 votes across three states would have changed the election result that was there. And there are issues that you have in Pennsylvania. You had different rules being used for fixing absentee ballots in Allegheny County and Philadelphia than were being used in other parts of the state. You had issues about whether or not you had problems with the mail-in ballots that were there and how they were counted, whether people were checking the signatures or not. I mean, the normal rate that you had for signature verification for mail-in ballots or absentee ballots would be like a 2% rejection rate. But, in areas there, Pennsylvania and Georgia, for example, you're talking about, hundredths of a percentage point that they were dropping. They just didn't have the time because they were so overwhelmed in terms of just being able to go and check the signatures. A number of states, they didn't even check them. Jimmy Carter, in the 2005 report that he did on election fraud, indicated that absentee ballots, let alone mail-in ballots, were a major source of fraud. At the time I was living in, earlier that year, I was living in Nevada, and the apartment that I was in, we got all sorts of absentee or mail-in ballots that were automatically sent. I had, like, in my apartment, my particular apartment, I had people from like four previous tenants whose absentee ballots were sent to my mailbox. You walk through the mail room that's there, and you literally would see 100 ballots just strewn on the floor because people were getting all these votes from everybody who didn't live at those places anymore. I could have picked them up, and I could have gone and filled them out and sent them in, and there's no way I would be caught. Nobody would know what they're going to do, check the DNA on the stamp that was licked there to see who sent it in. And you have no idea how much fraud was involved with it.
Can I tell you a story? I served on federal grand jury duty for a year. And one of the cases I handled was an individual picked up a ballot that wasn't his and turned it in to be in and voted absentee. The signature was checked against what was on record. On top of that, the real individual showed up and voted in that election. And that person was caught and I assume was punished by being on a grand jury duty. I wasn't sure what his ultimate punishment was. But mail-in ballots that aren't yours do tend to be...
Okay, let me ask you a question, David. Let me ask you a question. I can understand. Somebody showed up. They were voting. Somebody had filled in and voted for them by mail. And so that was caught. But how do they figure out who sent the mail-in ballot in? How did they figure that out? You must have seen the evidence.
Yes, I did see the evidence.
How did they figure out who sent it in?
The FBI did a DNA test on the mail-in ballot, and identify the person by DNA.
Okay, well, what percent of the mail-in ballots that were sent in during the 2020 election did they do DNA tests on?
I don't know. I have no idea. But
okay, my guess is
many,
pretty much zero.
None.
I've been involved in the Department of Justice. I've never, ever, I was making a joke about checking the DNA on the stamp that was licked there. You know, unless somebody's hair follicles fell into the ballot there and that somehow that was maintained when it was opened they separate out the cover. You know, the envelope gets separated from the ballot there. So, you know, what do you think? You get the DNA from just the person touching it? That doesn't make any sense. I don't know how they're going to go and figure out. I don't believe. I'm willing to bet you any amount of money that they don't do DNA tests on those things. Okay. Two,
then I was lied to.
Separate out the ballot from the envelope. Okay.
I was lied to, then. I take it.
Okay. Well, okay. But if you can find a news story someplace that corroborates that they do DNA tests on absentee ballots, I'll give you $100.
Gentlemen, with that, we're up against a hard break. Thank you for the call, sir. We're going to come right back. Rocky is going to be visiting with us when we come back. 406-721-1290 is our number. Dr. John Locke joining us, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. We'll continue right after this. Hey, welcome back to Talk Back, everybody. In our final segment now with Dr. John Locke, president and founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center. And folks are waiting on the phone. Rocky from Lolo. Rocky, good morning. You're on Talk Back with Dr. Locke. Go ahead.
Yes, I have two questions if you have time. The first one is regarding, you hear on the news, I think it's because if it's a drug crime, but if you're in possession of a firearm and you're involved with drugs, that's why it's an illegal possession of a firearm. And then my next question was, I'm going to become an executor of a trust. I haven't seen all the documents, but a friend of mine, he lives in two states. I know he's a gun collector. And the reason I know that is I target shoot with him down in Arizona. And silhouettes and varmints and so forth, but he has quite an extensive gun collection. I want to know, I need to go through proper channels to dispose of those firearms if that was necessary in his trust, or do I turn them over to a federal licensed firearm dealer? Thank you.
Well, my guess is those are the same thing, it's going to depend upon the individual state law that you're there. Obviously, in Montana, you say two states. I don't know what the other state is that you have there. But, with regard to the trust, are we talking about ones that you had to have, a class 3 type weapon? Is that what's in the trust, or is it just regular guns?
Sorry, Johnny, he hung up.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the bottom line is that if it's just regular guns, obviously you have accounting and stuff like that you have to do with a trust, but with regard to the actual law of disposing of the gun, in Montana, you can sell a gun privately. You can put the money in the trust then that you sell it. If it's a state that requires a background check on a private transfer of a gun, taking it to a licensed dealer would satisfy that.
All right, let's try to get one more call in here. This is Perry from Columbus, Montana. Perry, you're on with Dr. Lott. Go ahead.
Well, good morning, Dr. Lott. You know, I have a little experience with Class 3, that's not why I called, but if somebody passes on and they were in legal possession of a Class 3 firearm, it has to be right. surrendered to a dealer and then resold to repay the NICS tax to anybody who, or the registration tax to anybody who wants to procure it. It isn't illegal to have right. one. It's just illegal to have one without paying the taxes. But I have a quick comment for
well, that's the reason why I was asking if it was just Class 3, but I agree. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, I thought I heard Class 3 firearm. But anyways, no. I have a quick message for Harry and David, the perennial callers, multiple times a day, it seems like. You know, I want to just thank you for coming on and trying to educate people who are willfully blind to the reality of the world and the laws and the concept of self-defense. It just boggles me that people can live in Montana and the only thing he can come up with is to yammer again about President Trump and the stolen election. Well, I got a little movie for you. It's called 2000 Mules, Harry. Why don't you watch it, and then we'll have a talk. But, you know, thanks again for all of the work that you do to educate people, because education is seemingly our only and best weapon against this ignorance that seems to prevail around here. Thanks
all right.
again.
Thank you for the call, sir. Wait, we have about 2 minutes left in our time together. John, it's all yours.
Well, I really appreciate his comment. I, you know, Harry and Dave, I appreciate their calls in. But with Dave, it's often the same question many times over and over again. But, you know, it makes it lively. So, and to be honest, I'd rather talk to people who would otherwise disagree with me. That makes life more interesting than people who agree with me on stuff. I'd much rather go on CNN or MSNBC than on Newsmax or, you know, Fox or something like that. So, but, you know, it's just, we take the questions we have. I'm just appreciate people listening and calling in.
You bet. We're just about done with our time together. Give us your website where you can find out more about your work, sir.
So it's at crimeresearch.org, and people can sign up for our email blast that we send out once every 2 weeks.
Sounds
with
great.
our research that we put together.
Wonderful. Always a pleasure, Dr. Lott. Look forward to our next time.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.